This is Stockholm, Network Europe.
Paris, Berlin, Kiev, Ljubljana, Bratislava, Amsterdam, Bucharest.
Coming up in the program, the Nobel Prize announcements in medicine, physics and chemistry kickstart the Nobel season in Stockholm. Domino effect in France as the country considers a ban on smoking. Ecotourism is widely popular, but is medical tourism Europe's next big thing? We look at the complicated political landscape after Bosnia's election and the struggles of student life in Romania's crisis-ridden universities. These stories and more in this edition of Network Europe, a partnership of Europe's leading international broadcasters, now broadcast around the world, throughout Europe and over the internet. At the helm today, I'm Mark Cummins. Thanks for tuning in. Also, a little later in the program, how to stem the tide of illegal immigrants on the agenda when the European Commission met its fledgling counterpart, the African Union, in Ethiopia this week. But first, Monday kicked off Nobel Prize season in Sweden as the spotlight of international attention focuses on the awards, the pinnacle of achievement left to the world by the Swedish inventor of dynamite, Alfred Nobel, back in 1896 to reward scientific and literary development. In his will, Nobel wrote that his huge fortune and its generated interest shall be distributed annually by a foundation in the form of prizes to those who, during the preceding year, had conferred the greatest benefit on mankind. Five Nobel categories were specified: physics, chemistry, medicine, literature, and peace, with the sixth, economics, being set up by the Swedish Central Bank in 1968. On Monday, the Nobel Prize for Medicine was shared between two American researchers, Craig Mello and Andrew Fire, for their research into the role of RNA molecules, as explained here by the prize-awarding committee's Professor Bertil Fredholm.
RNA interference is a completely new way in which the genes that we all carry can be regulated. And it also provides a new way for experimentalists and perhaps also doctors to alter the processes in the cell so that we can find out what's going on and perhaps cure disease. The committee and the Nobel Assembly at Karolinska is convinced that this will have major therapeutic benefits.
The next day, another two Americans, John Mather and George Smoot, won the physics prize for work that helped shed more light on the beginning of the universe and the origin of galaxies and stars. Here's what the two winning space scientists had to say. John Mather and first, George Smoot.
It's not quite the same as making the discoveries themselves, but it's a pretty wonderful feeling. And I can look out my window and see the bright lights of the city, and it's a beautiful, clear day, and so it seems so perfect. It's like a nice day to be winning the prize.
We knew the work that we had done was wonderful. We knew that it was important, but when I look at what else has been done in the world of science, there are so many magnificent accomplishments everywhere.
So what will you do now, the rest of the day?
I think I'm going to talk on the phone all day.
The Nobel Prizes are not always shared and can run in the family. The Nobel Prize in Chemistry was awarded on Wednesday to American Roger D. Kornberg for his discoveries about how information in genes is copied. Kornberg's father also won a Nobel for Medicine in 1959. Kornberg was asked by Swedish radio how much his father's career affected him.
I wanted to be a scientist for as long as I can remember, from before he received the prize and for my entire period of education and work in science to this time. I can't really say that his receiving the prize had a direct influence. What I doubtless acquired for him was, at least in part, my passion for science.
Well, the United States' clean sweep of the science prizes provoked some adverse reaction in some Swedish newspapers, but more critical comment was saved for the discrepancy between male and female winners. Only 33 of the 763 Nobel laureates through the years have been women, with Marie Curie, the first, a two-time winner. There's always next week, of course, when the Economics Prize is awarded on Monday, followed by the Peace Prize on Friday. The Nobel Prize for Literature, always the subject of hot debate, will be awarded next Thursday. The prize winners will descend on Stockholm on December the 10th for the awards dinner hosted by the King and Queen of Sweden. You're listening to Network Europe. Now, academic excellence is in focus with the Nobel season, and it often kickstarts the discussion in other parts of the world as to why American universities take home the bulk of the prizes. Education is high on the agenda of late in Romania too, where universities in particular are struggling, despite the country's fast-track modernization reform in connection with its impending entry into the European Union in 2007. A serious brain drain and a long-neglected infrastructure are just two of the most pressing problems. Radio Romania's Iulian Murisan went to see Bucharest's largest student campus as the new academic year in Romania kicks off.
In post-communist Romania, education has been constantly a Cinderella at the budget allocation ball. It always received an average 4% of the GDP, and even that money seems to have disappeared into a black hole, because at present the Romanian education system, especially higher education, is in a deplorable state. The president of Romania had to turn up at the opening of the new university year on October the 1st and to criticize the Ministry of Education, pulling an alarm signal as to the future of Romanian education.
Unfortunately, Romania was ignorant enough not to allocate the necessary resources to the education infrastructure.
At present, the Romanian state spends 500 euros per year for one student, while other European countries spend 10 up to 20 times more. It was only this year that education received more from the budget, that is, almost 5%. Minister of Education Mihail Hârdău is optimistic, however.
This year, the government has pumped into education a sum which is the equivalent of what it has received in the last 10 years. These sums show the clear determination of the government in placing education among Romania's priorities. At the end of this year, we'll have almost two-thirds of the 300 student hostels renovated according to international standards.
Speaking of student campuses and hostels, I decided to visit Bucharest's biggest campus. There's quite a bustle here. School has started, but the campus looks like a construction site.
One can hardly breathe because of the dust. And they're still working on it, renovating.
Four guys are beating the dust from a carpet with baseball bats.
Unfortunately, it is us who have to clean the room and to fix everything in it. They haven't repaired anything in these rooms for 2 years. The bathroom looks horrible. The carpet you can see for yourself. You also have to whitewash the walls.
It's your first year here, or you've been living here for...
I've been living here for 3 years.
And you like it?
Yes, I like it, considering the price. If you consider the state of the rooms, no, I don't like that we don't have a toilet now. Started repairing it just when the year started. I think they should have done this during the holiday.
What's the price?
Per month, it's about 700,000 lei.
It's about 20 euros.
About 20, like 30 euros,
20, 30
yes.
Euros.
Nu am prins repartițiile și caut.
I haven't received a room from the university, so I'm looking to buy one. I'm willing to pay 200 euros.
The Ministry of Education is optimistic. While students live and learn in improvised spaces, there are still suspicions of corruption among the hostel administrators, and the illegal sale of hostel rooms in the campus continues, because universities can meet only 30% of the accommodation demand.
Iulian Murisan with that report. Still ahead, domino effect in France as the country moots a ban on smoking in public areas, in line with a raft of other European countries. You're listening to Network Europe. Now, as Romania and Bulgaria prepare for EU membership, one country, Poland, is already marking the changes since it joined in 2004. Growing numbers of Britons and Germans are namely taking advantage of Poland's expanding private health sector for cheap dental care and even cosmetic surgery. Medical tourism has taken off in the historic city of Krakow, now a destination for many low-cost airlines. Radio Polonia's John Bokamp reports from Krakow.
Since Poland's entry into the European Union in 2004, there has been a growth in tourism in the country's southern city of Kraków. The city's medical trade has also taken advantage of the union's enlargement. Already a few years back, there were stories in the British press that addressed the possibility of travelling within the EU to get specialist treatment without the queues and without having to spend too much well-earned cash for the privilege. Specialist treatment is now only a few hours away and costs a fraction of what it would cost in Britain. Jerzy Postawka, a tourism specialist based in Kraków, is pioneering a new program for tourists who want to take advantage of Poland's jewel in the crown. He told me more.
It's a medical travel, and basically it's the traveling to get some treatment, like, for example, dentists, opticians, and also plastic surgery. I'm ensuring the accommodation. They can pick it from different standards and different types of accommodation. Then I'm organizing a treatment. I'm making the schedule of visits and everything. Usually these are people who are over 30 years old and they are just looking for a good treatment.
The cost of treatment is probably the most important factor for people who would want to come to Kraków. Jerzy explains the difference in price and what you would get in Kraków for the same amount of money paid for specialist treatment in the UK.
Definitely it's a way of saving money. I would say like this, that to come here, including the cost of travel, including the cost of accommodation, and including the treatment, the amount is the same that for treatment in Western Europe.
I put the idea to Max, a Brit currently on a short holiday in Kraków.
I know it's a beautiful city, and if you can get the same treatment done here for less money, then it's definitely worth it.
The opinion of Jerzy is to get Western Europeans to come to Kraków, take in the atmosphere, and relax while the specialists do their thing.
Now, whether or not you're in Poland, the UK, or China for that matter, doctors will tell you that smoking kills. After Ireland, Italy, Sweden and Spain, France could become the next European country to introduce a blanket ban on smoking in public areas. That's what a parliamentary committee recommended this week after 5 months of consultations with doctors, tobacconists and trade unions. According to government figures, some 35% of the French population uses tobacco, and some 66,000 die of smoke-related illnesses every year. The measure would be enforced from September 2007 at the latest, though the committee held open a possible delay till summer of 2008 for some establishments, including nightclubs and restaurants. The tobacco lobby is outraged. But Radio France International's Nick Champeau found that smokers in Paris are already making the mental adjustments.
Enjoying a cigarette whilst reading the paper at a cafe counter in the morning, or a small cigar with a glass of brandy after a fine meal. All this may be over soon if the ban goes through. Customers of the A La Fontaine cafe restaurant here in Paris are getting used to the idea. At least Camille is. She smokes 20 a day. In fact, she's smoking now.
This is one of the best cigarettes, the one after lunch with a glass of wine. All this will be over soon, but we'll get used to it. We'll be miserable and smoke outside under the rain, and after a while we'll give up smoking.
The A La Fontaine restaurant opened a week ago. Its owner, Xavier, says the non-smoking section is the most comfortable one. He doesn't think a ban will be bad for business.
Many customers no longer eat in restaurants because of the smoke, so they're going to come back to us after the ban. So we may lose clients, but we'll have new ones.
That's partly what happened in places where bans are already in force, such as Scotland and Ireland. Surprisingly, public opinion in France is largely in favor of the ban. In fact, there was not a single customer against it at the A La Fontaine restaurant, so I went to the National Assembly. I met André Santini there, indulging his cigar-smoking habit. He is member of the Parliamentary Commission which wrote the report, and he's also president of the National Assembly's Cigar Amateurs Club. I told him smoking was bad for his health.
Churchill carried on smoking cigars until the age of 92, so I can handle it too. I'm a defender of the last bastion of freedoms in a parliament where we are expanding the hairdressing saloon and we are shutting down the tobacco shop. What kind of segregation is that?
The tobacco shop of the National Assembly is closing down next year. Morissette has been working there for almost 30 years. She'll retire in 6 months, and no one will replace her. She is dead against the ban.
I think it's interfering in people's lives. It's like seatbelts in cars. I don't believe in passive smoking. What about pollution and pesticides and asbestos? All that's much worse.
The tobacco lobby agrees and is warning of dire financial consequences if the ban comes into effect. But Axel Poniatowski, another member of the commission, says the recommendations are reasonable.
It will still be possible to smoke in restaurant area as long as it is outside. Secondly, even in the workplace, if whatever company agreed to create this special area, then it will be possible. Thirdly, it's not immediate, and there will be a tax compensation for the tobacco shop as long as their total sales is going down.
Professor Robert Molimar is France's most senior and most respected medical expert on smoking. He says the ban is good news for both non-smokers and smokers.
There are a lot of situations that I call signal situations that push them to lighten a cigarette. For instance, coffee time. These situations are very numerous. And if you suppress these environmental stimuli, then you may help the smoker.
Help smokers give up the habit, that is. Professor Molimar says a ban in public areas would be a more efficient alternative to price rises. The government has increased the price of cigarettes twice in the last 2 years. Molimar says it's counterproductive, especially for poor people who make up the majority of smokers in France.
If you spend so much for tobacco, you put less meat in the plate of your children, you don't go to the doctor. Hygiene would be bad.
The government knows it would be masochistic to introduce a price rise before next April's presidential elections, but Prime Minister Dominique de Villepin announced this week he was considering adopting the ban by decree in the next few days.
Now, general elections took place in Bosnia-Herzegovina last weekend, but many Bosnians are still trying to work out what the results mean for their country's future. The winners seem to be split between those who want to reform the country and its divisions and those who want to retain the ethnic divide between Bosnian Serbs on one hand and Croats and Muslims on the other. The international community is planning on handing over power to local politicians next year, but says that first, controversial reforms need to take place. From Sarajevo, Deutsche Welle's Niklas Walton reports.
Flags, banners, pop stars and slogans. On the face of it, elections in Bosnia are just like those in most other countries. But Bosnia is far from a normal European country. With all its different layers of government and divisions along ethnic lines, politics here is a complicated business. Here's Jan Zlatan Kulinovic of the Youth Information Centre.
Unfortunately, we have 14 governments, 16 parliaments, 142 municipalities, 121 ministers, and it's generally a bureaucratic, rigid system.
This is Banja Luka, the capital of the Serb part of the country, Republika Srpska. Bosnia's ethnic division into two entities, this part and the Muslim Croat Federation, was a key issue in the elections. Muslim and Croat voters largely supported handing power back to a central government, fitting in with the international community's plans for giving power back to Bosnians next year. But the Serbs did not. Milka Mimic is a young Banja Luka resident who sees no problem with wanting to protect the integrity and powers of Republika Srpska.
I don't think the nationalism is really bad. I mean, it's good to feel your own nation, to love it, to cherish your culture and everything. It's just that the world is brought to a level that is equal to fascism, which is like really not the case. I mean, I really like who I am. I feel really comfortable in shoes of being a Serbian girl, and I like my culture, my family, all the beliefs that we respect and everything. But I don't think it's something wrong.
Reform negotiations between the more nationalist Serbs and the other newly elected Bosnian politicians are going to be closely followed by the international community to see if the conditions for the handing over of power will be met. One area where reform would have a real impact on everyday life is education. These students are part of a multi-ethnic school project in the city of Mostar. Serjan, a Serb from Zvornik, describes the reaction of his friends when he told them he was going to be educated with other Bosnians of different backgrounds.
The first emotions they showed when they heard that I was accepted was like, Mostar, that's like Muslims and Croats. There's no Serbs there. You're going to hate it. Go back. Don't go there. It's like this. So that's like something prejudice, because this is still an old-fashioned country. They don't believe that we can make up.
For most Bosnians, schools are divided. In many cases, the same buildings are used by two sets of students from different ethnic backgrounds. They either use different entrances or swap students, teachers and textbooks halfway through each day. Mirna Jančić is the development director of this multi-ethnic project in Mostar. She says the country needs to find ways for children to integrate, or it'll store up more ethnic trouble for the future.
The dangers are not so much that you will have people in the future, future leaders of Bosnia, who will disagree on what happened, but that they will have been educated according to a principle which denies the possibility that what they know is wrong. Children are educated never to question the authority or never to question the truth of what they're being taught as part of their textbooks.
Education is just one area where Bosnia remains a divided country. Bosnia's newly elected politicians have a difficult task ahead if they're to fashion such division into a more normal country. Some, with the support of their voters, obviously don't want to. But whether or not ethnic divisions remain, with other concrete problems to deal with, such as a faltering economy and high unemployment, Bosnia's voters of every type will be hoping their politicians will find enough common ground to make a difference.
You're listening to Network Europe. The European Commission is just back from talks in Africa this week. On the agenda, the unfolding humanitarian crisis in Darfur and how to stem the tide of illegal immigrants to Europe. From Brussels, Stephen Castle reports.
It's not often that a European Commission president finds himself negotiating at midnight with a man wearing leopard skin shoes. But this week, José Manuel Barroso has been in Africa on a visit dominated by the humanitarian crisis in Darfur. Before touching down in the Sudanese capital Khartoum, officials were a little nervous. The country's president, Omar al-Bashir, often cancels meetings without notice. But Mr. Barroso was admitted to the official presidential residence late at night to meet a Sudanese leader wearing full white Muslim dress and those traditional leopard skin shoes. Mr. Bashir is a military hard man whose government shows limited respect for human rights. But he holds the key to ending the war in Darfur, where government troops and a host of rebel militia are doing battle. Sudan refuses to allow United Nations troops into the province of Darfur, where aid agencies fear another looming catastrophe. It's an area that does not need more tragedy. An estimated 200,000 people have died and 2 million have been displaced in the last 3 years. After 2 hours of talks, Mr. Barroso emerged mildly encouraged. Mr. Bashir rejected calls for the UN to replace 7,000 ill-equipped and ineffectual African Union peacekeepers already in Darfur. But he seemed open to a compromise idea of increasing the number of international troops, providing control stays in African hands. Later, Mr. Barroso flew to Ethiopia's capital, Addis Ababa, where no fewer than 10 European commissioners met their counterparts in the African Union. This was the first ever meeting of the EU's most senior officials outside European soil. Just 6 years old, the African Union is being built in the image of the EU. But with 53 member states, including some of the most oppressive regimes on the planet, the AU is hardly a carbon copy of its European cousin. Some officials question the value for money of such an international get-together. But the number of Europeans in the Ethiopian capital illustrates how much the organizations have to discuss. The gathering was dominated by Darfur, development, trade and immigration. And Mr. Barroso's African visit underlines how the problems faced by Europe and Africa bind them together. European diplomacy and the sort of soft power that the EU does well could help avert a fresh crisis in Darfur. Meanwhile, Spain, Italy and Malta are among the European countries struggling to manage an influx of African migrants. Only if trade and development policies create a more stable and prosperous Africa will that flow of migrants slow, allowing Europe to manage its borders. In other words, for Europe, helping Africa means helping itself.
The Journeys of Franz Kafka is the name of a new internet project in which award-winning Czech photographer Jan Jindra follows the footsteps of the literary great, taking black and white pictures of many of the places Kafka visited. One of the project's aims is to dispel the idea that the German-speaking author never left Prague. In fact, he travelled rather extensively around the Czech Republic and to countries such as Germany, France and Italy. Radio Prague's Ian Willoughby has the story.
Max Brod is known to most people as the person who saved and published Kafka's work after his death. Project organizer Jurita Matyashova says the two were also traveling companions.
He and Max Brod took a Baedeker guidebook and made their way through Italy, Switzerland and then on to France. They were really like two regular young guys, touring about and visiting interesting places. Few people know this about Kafka.
While doing research for the new project, its creators also learned a lot more about Franz Kafka's wide-ranging interests.
It seems like he must have had more than 24 hours in a day. His interest in various new developments in the fields of culture and technology was incredible. He was interested in everything from modern dance to vegetarianism to the first air show in Italy. He liked going to the cinema, went motorcycling with his uncle Siegfried. He was an unusually curious person.
The Journeys of Franz Kafka project has seen photographer Jan Jindra visit 60 locations to date. Jurita Matyashova explains how the writer's travels were retraced.
The main consultants for our project are two Kafkologists, real experts on Kafka. One of them is Dr. Josef Čermák, one of the co-founders of the Franz Kafka Society. The other is Dr. Hans-Gerd Koch, who edited a collection of Kafka's correspondence. They recreated his travels from diaries, letters and postcards. And the photographer, Jan Jindra, tries to capture the locations in the most authentic possible way.
But it isn't just the people behind the project who've been learning about the various travels of Franz Kafka.
In Germany, especially in Berlin, people know that Kafka used to visit. But in Switzerland, when we toured about visiting the hotels where he stayed on his travels, they only knew he'd been there in one hotel. It was a hotel in which the owners are really interested in its history. Now we're going to Italy. In most places, people don't know, so it's a surprise to them.
The Journeys of Franz Kafka project, which has received funding from the Czech-German Fund for the Future, can be found online at www.franzkafka.info.
And as always, if you'd like to listen to this or any of our programs again, you can by logging on to our new website at www.networkeurope.org. You'll also find information there on how you can subscribe to our podcast. We love to get feedback on our programs. You can send your comments, suggestions, ideas and even criticisms to our email address, contact@networkeurope.org. That address again, it's contact@networkeurope.org. That's all we have time for today. This program is a partnership of Radio France International, Radio Sweden, Radio Polonia, Deutsche Welle, Radio Netherlands, Radio Romania International, Radio Slovakia, Radio Prague, Radio Ukraine, and Radio Slovenia. Network Europe will be back again next week. On behalf of our pan-European team, this is Mark Cummins. Thanks for joining us.
I know a girl laying down, she's sleeping. up, she watches TV, counting cracks in the ceiling. No, I don't know what she's thinking, so I give up waiting for someone waiting, talking to someone staring.
Something in common, she's as different as I am.